In this episode of Skeptico, DJ Grothy clears up some common misconceptions about science.
There's not one thing called science that says X, Y, and Z. There are human scientists, each with their own motivations and their own backgrounds and their own biases, and it just so happens that the methods of science are the best methods we've found to overcome personal bias, personal motivations, and all that stuff.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by a voice you may recognize, or at least I hope you recognize, because he's a host of a very, very excellent radio show and podcast named Point of Inquiry. He's also program director at the Center for Inquiry in Amherst, New York, as well as an accomplished stage magician. DJ Grothy, welcome to Skeptico.
Alex, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show. You guys address many of the things we care about here, and even if the answers aren't always the same, we really agree about the questions. So it's a pleasure to be here, Alex.
Well, that's awesome, and really that's, I think, a great starting point. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Point of Inquiry and the Center for Inquiry, purpose, mission, those kind of things.
The Center for Inquiry is, well, it's this think tank affiliated with the State University of New York. We're collaborating with SUNY Buffalo on a new master's degree called Science in the Public, and we also have various programs of public education and advocacy, some of which deal directly with the paranormal, pseudoscience, fringe science, but we really look at all kinds of questions in society through, call it the lens of the scientific outlook. We try to look at the implications of the worldview of science for the big questions in our world, not just about the things that go bump in the night, but especially the paranormal, the supernatural, ethical questions. And my background in magic really turns me on to the area that we look at called the paranormal. That's exciting as a former magician, but I think we also address other questions that have really important things to say about the culture war issues, political questions even, and increasingly even economic questions. So it's not just the supernatural and the paranormal.
Right. And, you know, on the show, you've talked to a lot of very, very smart people. What I really like about your show is you seem to find somehow that balance between making it accessible and yet not dumbing it down. And I think you also do usually a very good job of asking questions that probe the other side of the issue. What has the process been like for you talking to some of these folks? What do you think are one or two of the biggest takeaways and or ways that it's changed your outlook?
Well, two ways of addressing that question. One, I should say that, you know, I really lucked out in Point of Inquiry because I do almost none of the work. Thomas Donnelly is the producer of the show, and he also heads up our digital media here at the Center for Inquiry. He approached us a year and a half ago, and he said, man, you guys, we should have a podcast. We should be doing digital radio. We're gratified now that we're on a number of actual radio stations, community and campus radio stations around the country. But he talked us into it, and he does really all of the work. You know, my job is to have a weekly conversation with a really interesting person. So I just want to get that out there. He does the hard work. Now, regarding these conversations, not only are these guests really the leaders of their field, their various fields, you know, they're real smart cookies, but they are really interested in engaging on their issues of concern. So we bring them on the show not just so they can preach to the choir, as it were, not just so they can, you know, tell everyone exactly what they believe, but defend their positions as well. And we think that's important. Indeed, that's the point of inquiry, knowing why you believe what you believe. These conversations really aim to get at that.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about, personally, DJ, how you came to, if you will, a skeptical point of view? I mean, was it a long-held belief? Was there a certain event in your life that kind of triggered you to say, hey, wait a minute, a lot of people are going one way, and I really see it a totally different way now?
Well, there are a couple things in my, I guess, call it my biography, my personal history, that have informed my perspective. So on the one side of it, I was a really religious teenager for a period. Then I went to Bible college. I was trying to be a minister, at least taking homiletics courses. I ended up taking degrees in English and psychology. But through that process, I became kind of a skeptic of religion. That's a long story. I'm reminded of Diderot, the Enlightenment philosophes' line, Diderot's line, there's nothing like a good Jesuit education to make you an atheist. Well, I got a good, nice liberal arts education at Bible college, and a consequence of which I became kind of skeptical about, call them fundamentalist views about God. But your question was about skepticism in general. When I was a teenager, before I became really religious, if you can imagine this, I was very, paranormal, right? I was a paranormalist or a supernaturalist. I was into Wicca. In St. Louis, there used to be a store. I don't know if it's still there. It's called the Alchemist Shop. I used to go and buy herbs, and I was very interested in, I was very interested in the spirit world and, you know, lighting candles. You know, I was a teenage seeker. I was I bought into many of these claims, and not just out of faith, but because I really looked into it and the stuff seemed sensible to me. Mm-hmm. Now, early on, also as a teenager, I ended up getting into magic, the magician's art, legerdemain or conjuring, and just so happens that the more you learn about magic, I think there is a direct relationship to being skeptical of some of these things. Now, some of my best magician buddies would take exception with that statement. You know, I have magician friends who believe in psychic powers, even as they use fake magician methods to pretend to be psychic on stage. Mm-hmm. But it was that background that, I guess, in addition to some other influences, that got the ball rolling, helping me be pretty skeptical.
Fascinating. That really is very, very interesting. You know, so now kind of bringing it up to the present date, you're involved with the organization, the Center for Inquiry. I know you're involved with many good works that organization is, outreach programs that seem to have the honest intent of improving people's lives, and that's to be commended. But on the show, and you knew there was going to be a but there someplace, but I wanted to explore a little bit the other side of skepticism. And that is, you know, I'm going to postulate that, you know, is it possible that the skeptical community, including CFI and PsyCop and other groups, are actually stifling scientific inquiry? And I thought we might explore a couple of ways that I think that happens and then get your views.
Okay, before we get to the couple of ways, let me just commend you for bringing that up, because you're spot on correct that we need to be on guard. Call it scientism, you know, kind of the religion of science, and I'm speaking metaphorically. I don't believe literally science is a religion. I just want to get that out there. I had a debate at Stanford on this point and argued that science, of course, is not a religion. I don't want to be misquoted. Mm-hmm. But metaphorically, you know, there are scientists who think that not only is science the best way of finding things out, but that it's the only way, and they reject out of hand any possible claims that don't fit in with their preconceived scientific assumptions about the world.
Right.
We say, be on guard against that. We say, and maybe we haven't always said this, you know, science has some self-correcting mechanisms in it, and we like to think here at the Center for Inquiry we're a little self-correcting too. We say, don't be a debunker. Don't reject out of hand any claim. Be open-minded. And in fact, we think being open-minded is incredibly compatible, in fact, foundational to the kind of skepticism that we promote. We could talk more about that, but this is a very important point, and one that we like to talk to the skeptical community a lot about, because it is just so important.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. Actually, and that was the point I was going to make, but I think I would like to chat a little bit more about it and maybe dig into some of the details. And what I was going to say is really, I think that too often the skeptical community doesn't properly differentiate between debunking on one hand and analyzing scientific research on the other. And I think that debunking, there's a place for that. I mean, if Joe Nickel or Michael Shermer is out investigating the breatharians who think they can live on nothing but air,
right.
You know, without denigrating...
I love those I love those breatharians there in Australia, and if they have some claims, let's look into them. But yeah, I get where you're saying. Sometimes it's okay to reject something if it's just so ridiculous, but we try not to really reject any claim out of hand. I should say that. Joe Nickel is a great exemplar of this. You mentioned his name, that's why I jumped in here. He takes great pains to take everybody very seriously, every claimant. And in fact, seriously scolds, he might not like me saying this, but he seriously scolds the skeptics out there who are less than skeptical. They're debunkers who say, oh, can you believe this guy? You hear what this guy is saying. It's so ridiculous. And Joe says, how do you know it's ridiculous? Have you looked at the claims? Have you looked at the evidence?
You know, but DJ, I understand the point you're making, but there's a subtler point in there too. And that's that I would expect there to be some differentiating going on. I mean, some groups are not to be taken as seriously as others. My real point is that when we move into the area of analyzing scientific research, I think an extra guard needs to be made. For one thing, we have to respect scientists as already passing the criteria that we put in front of them. The gatekeepers are already there. If you're a well-qualified, well-educated, well-credentialed parapsychologist publishing in peer-reviewed journals that are respected and have all the credentials associated with them, there doesn't need to be an extra layer of analysis or casting doubt on that. And I think that's often done. You wind up, in particular, someone like James Randi winds up suggesting that, hey, all paranormal researchers need to have a trained magician on hand so that they can make sure they're not being fooled. Well, no, they don't. They need to just follow the standard methods and protocols that the scientific community has already put in place to figure out whether science is valid.
You just mentioned, well, there's just a lot of fodder in there to give a rejoinder to you. That was a great kind of a great survey of what's going on out there. But I would suggest that not just in parapsychology, I mean, you said something like in parapsychology, they already stand up to the rigors of real science, so we don't need to, you know, set up any more roadblocks for them. Or you said something like that. That's a paraphrase. Well, I think not just in parapsychology, but in psychology or any science, we need to be even more rigorous than we're now being. Look at even in the Journal of American Medical Association or, you know, the Columbia Prayer Study or, you know, respected scientific journals and publications or the stem cell cloning thing in Korea. I mean, do you remember that?
Sure.
So it's not just parapsychology. In the sciences, we need to be even more rigorous, even more strenuous in our efforts to weed out those claims which don't stand up, to critical examination. Now, regarding parapsychology, I think scientists can do a better job at a kind of a starting point, taking people at their word and not assuming everyone is a huckster or a crook. And so scientists who look more than skeptically, they look very suspiciously at any claimant, well, I think that's a bad thing, and I'm the first to say it. If anyone says they have evidence to, that they think will persuade me or someone else that this parapsychological or this paranormal claim is true, I say, in the spirit of finding things out, I say, bring it on. Let's look at the evidence. I'm going to take you at your word that you're not trying to pull one over on me, that you're serious about the claim. That being said, after 30 years of the Center for Inquiry, PSYCOP, which is a program here at the Center for Inquiry, looking at these claims, it just so happens, as earnestly as we've looked at them, we've never once found something to worth assenting to. Now, I use the word worth. By that, I mean, you know, it just the evidence compels assenting to the proposition. Not that it's bad or good, but, you know, just that it's good enough argument, good enough evidence to warrant belief.
Sure.
Or assenting to that proposition. Parapsychology That's, you know, there are parapsychology journals that are set up kind of with something like peer review. Just so happens, in my opinion, and this is a claim, we could look into it, they're not set up as rigorously as, say, the Journal of American Medical Association would be set up, or some of the others. Now, that reflects some of my bias there.
Well, we don't know, and I don't have that data, you know, on my fingertips. Although I have read and I've heard actually from skeptics who've acknowledged, you know, actually the parapsychology community has a better track record of, for instance, double-blind studies than other fields because the rigor that's been associated with them has been so stringent.
Right, they have to be beyond suspicion, so they're extra special.
Right,
yeah, I think there is some. They're extra special. They're extra cautious. Extra special in their, turning over every stone.
But I think your point stands, and it's a good one. You know, the only thing I'd add slightly before moving on to the second topic, and that's that, you know, I think one of the other misimpressions that gets delivered by the skeptical community is that there's this kind of monolith of science and truth and virtue. And as we all know, it's really much more messy than that. And it's controversial in every area. And there's everyone trying to figure that out.
Well, we're going to turn into a self-congratulatory party because I'm agreeing with you so much, but you're spot on right. Science is, there's not one thing called science that says X, Y, and Z. There are human scientists, each with their own motivations and their own backgrounds and their own biases, and it just so happens that the methods of science are the best methods we've found to overcome personal bias, personal motivations, and all that stuff. Science is not perfect. It's a human thing. People aren't perfect. But if you're serious about looking into the claims of the paranormal or parapsychological, there's no better way to do it than through the methods of science. But that is not the same thing as, you know, like looking in Haunted Times or one of these great magazines I love reading, and you see an ad for, not a Geiger counter, but one of those other gizmos they have on TV where you
right.
supposedly, you know, look at the magnetic indications of ghostly phenomena. That's not looking at something scientifically.
Right.
That is buying a gizmo to appear scientific. It's not what scientists necessarily do. So I draw that distinction as well.
And I would agree. Let me move on to another point and get your reaction to that. And that's that another way that I believe that the skeptical community can and does stifle scientific inquiry is that it rallies around defending a paradigm rather than really looking at the data. And the paradigm, of course, is reductionistic, materialistic, and atheistic. And while there's nothing inherently wrong with these philosophies, the paradigm, it does create a certain lens that allow people to see things only one way. And most importantly, from a scientific perspective, I think they sometimes distort the data. And if I could, let me bring it down to a specific, and perhaps this is an area you feel comfortable talking about, perhaps not, but I think it's an example that illustrates it for me, and that's the whole near-death experience. I mean, here's a real paradigm buster, because if consciousness does survive death, then brain equals mind doesn't work anymore, and materialism fails, and a bunch of other things have to be reanalyzed and rethought. But what is your take on near-death experience?
I am of the worldview that, you know, call it scientific naturalism, that says there's no splitting of the world. We haven't found any evidence to support the claim that the world should be bifurcated into the transcendent and the material. I'm a materialist, a naturalist. That being said, I am really open to evidence to the contrary. I would love, and in fact, any scientist, I'm not a scientist, but any scientist would love to find scientific evidence for the supernatural or the, you know, mind-body dualism or that there is a heavenly realm. Not only because it'd be great for his or her career, but because, man, wouldn't we all love to find evidence sufficient to warrant belief, even for the skeptical scientist. I would love to know in quotes, as a scientist knows anything, that the supernatural or the transcendent exists. I am very open to that, and I want to say that because I'm not dead set against that belief. I just haven't found any evidence for it. Scientists who have looked into the matter, Sue Blackmore, others, about near-death experience, just haven't found evidence to support the claims. That does not mean that the topic shouldn't continue to be an area of research. In fact, the questions posed by near-death experience researchers still warrant our critical attention. But you began that question by asking me about kind of scientific bias
paradigm, really.
Or that we have, or look at me, I'm including myself in the community of scientists. I don't do science. I talk about science a lot, but that scientists have a paradigm that says there is one reality, not two realities. And therefore, you're suggesting that closes them off to even the possibility that there's something transcendent. Here's my response to that. I would draw a distinction between something called metaphysical naturalism and methodological naturalism. When I, as a scientist, there I go again, am in my lab with beakers and test tubes and a white lab coat, I have to have some rules of the game. I have to have some assumptions in order to do my job. And methodological naturalism is the means by which I find things out, and it's based on that assumption that there is no supernatural. It is not a faith commitment because it's only about method. I know many scientists who use the method of naturalism, they use methodological naturalism, who are believers. They still believe in the supernatural. They just say their test tubes, their beakers, their scientific research can't examine it because they're dealing with the material world, and by definition, the other stuff is immaterial. It's supernatural. It's not natural. But there's this other thing called metaphysical naturalism, which is more of a worldview than just a method. And I'm kind of a fan of both of those things, methodological naturalism and metaphysical naturalism, kind of that worldview based on methodological naturalism. But you don't have to be a metaphysical naturalist to be a methodological naturalist. Now, I just threw out a lot of words. I'm not trying to obfuscate the conversation by throwing out those categories, but if we allow that those categories exist, methodological versus metaphysical naturalism, then you can't paint all scientists with the same brush and say that because of your paradigm or worldview, it is impossible for you to even be open-minded about these questions. Here's a case in point. I believe, you're talking about near-death experience, but let's talk about another area of research that could overturn the paradigm. And that's prayer studies. There are some scientists, and I think they're wrong, who say, science has no business looking at those questions. Those are religious questions. You keep your religion out of my science, and I'll keep my science out of your religion, and never the twain shall meet. Well, I think they're wrong.
Yeah, but DJ, neither you or I agree with that position. And I mean,
I disagree with those scientists who say that. But you're right. You and I agree that science can look into these questions, and the scientists that are looking into those questions, I believe are doing it earnestly without an axe to grind. In fact, many of the major prayer studies that have been done over the past 15 years, 12 years, have been done by believers,
sure,
in quotes, believers, of one stripe or another, who just, they desperately, they're on record as really wanting to validate these claims, prove them, whatever, but they just haven't found the evidence. And you could go back to the history of psychical research and find the same situation. You look back at J.B. Rhine, kind of the father of parapsychology. He planned a career as a minister before losing his, this is kind of my read on his biography, but he planned his planned a career as a minister before losing his faith in religion at college. So the pendulum swung. He became a scientist. It's interesting that in history of psychical research, there's that kind of emotional pendulum swinging among many psychical researchers. And he was steeped in college at the University of Chicago in this kind of materialism, this naturalism that I was talking about. And guess what? He didn't like it. He didn't like the implications of scientific naturalism. The implications are, when you die, you're dead. There is no mind-body dualism. There is no God, no answer to prayer, no ultimate meaning to the universe. And these implications don't sit well with a lot of people. So what was he very open about? Well, he became not only concerned with these implications, but he wanted to prove scientific naturalism wrong. If all there is in you know, the universe is matter, then, as you said, souls don't exist, mind-body dualism is kaput. That bothered him, so he set out to use science to prove the claims of the psychical researchers. You know, he really set up the field of ESP research. That's a bias. Now, I think you're right. Maybe there are some scientists who are just diehard atheists who want to use their science to diminish other people's faith. But I think by and large, and I'll try to get you to agree to this, by and large, most scientists are the kind of skeptic that I talked about in the beginning of our discussion, open-minded skeptics who say, this, you know, given the information I have so far, this is my worldview, but, you know, you give me better information, or you show me new data, man, I'll change my mind like that.
Well, I think you make some valid points there. I guess where I was going, and perhaps I did paint with too broad of a brush, but I think the effects of paradigm are more subtle than that. You know, getting back to the NDE thing for a second, you know, just look at it, take a big step back.
Yeah.
Tremendous natural history here, right? Throughout recorded history, near-death experiences. Across cultures, near-death experiences. From a purely scientific standpoint,
right,
these are real markers that something's going on.
What they indicate that there's something to look at.
Something, exactly. I'm not overreaching that. Let me go a little bit further. Yeah, just that something deserves investigation. Now, the reaction to that, I think, it has been, and this is, I think, the history, whether we like it or not, the skeptical community has come forward with really what would amount to kind of flimsy theories if we were really to look at it from a scientific standpoint.
Elaborate on that, because I don't follow.
Well, it's the last gasps of a dying brain. It's fear of death. These were theories, and they're still very prominent theories, that there's no basis for, there's no data for. And let me just make one more point, and then I want to get your response to it. And now that the research is coming in, the research doesn't prove conclusively what near-death experiences are, but the research is moving us further and further away from these theories that we've had. For example, that it's a physical experience that goes on in the brain. No, the data doesn't look that way from the studies that have been done.
From those studies that you're mentioning. Yeah, we could tit-for-tat studies, but yeah.
But here's the point I wanted to make. Not to get into a tit-for-tat debate on NDE, but to point out the power of paradigm and how blind spots do crop up in the skeptical community, and this is one of them. And the point I was going to make about Shermer cited this study from The Lancet, published a very highly respected international medical journal, and the principal researcher was so offended by his interpretation that he actually had to publish a counter to it to say, no, you totally misinterpreted what I said. It wasn't a blow against NDE. So, and the point again,
yeah,
is...
that stuff, hurrah for science, by the way, because that stuff should happen in science. People correct each other. They say, oh, no, you got it wrong or you misunderstood. I think that's a triumph for science. But yes, skeptics, do they have bias? Yes. Yes. Do they need to be on guard on it? Do they need to be on guard against it? As I said at the very beginning, they do. And that's, you know, a clarion call CFI is offering out there a lot. But, you know, don't be, you've heard this, I heard it in church as a teenager, don't be so open-minded that your noggin falls out. On the other hand, don't reject anything out of hand. Don't say there ain't no way that that could possibly happen. Be open-minded, at least to allow for the possibility. I want to, not to talk about NDEs, let's talk about one other thing, because I've only read, four or five books on near-death experiences, but I've had some personal experiences of another variety that, had I a different paradigm, I'd be talking a different talk about them. And that is, a couple years ago, in my apartment, I have this fold-out couch in the living room, and I go to sleep, fold-out couch, bought a nice TV, so I'm enjoying it in the living room, and I wake up in the middle of the night, and I'm unable to move, and I swear to you that I saw, he didn't look like an alien, but I saw this kind of short guy in the corner of the room. The room is kind of well lit with all the windows open, even at night, because I live on a corner of a street, and street lights, flood in the room. And I saw this guy whose mouth was just going up and down. It was kind of scary and odd, and I tried to move. I couldn't move, and finally I moved. Finally, I felt paralyzed, and when I finally, got unparalyzed, wiggled myself out of it, struggled, strained against it, the guy wasn't there. Now, what do I have to say about that real experience that I had? It was real. I didn't imagine it. It was, it was a physical thing that happened to me. It wasn't I didn't just hallucinate that I couldn't move, right? And I know that my eyes were open from the evidence of my senses. Well, science has some really good guesses, some evidence for what was going on in my brain, but 150 years ago, the best evidence I would have had, or 300 years ago, would have been that was a demonic experience. Or, 30 years ago, the best evidence, the most scientific evidence that would have been available to me anyway, would have been, well, maybe that was an alien, right? If not a gray, kind of a more well-kempt, alien, because he had black hair, this guy that I saw. He was short, he was little, and he was scary. So what we know now is that there are hypnagogic or hypnopompic states that our bodies experience when our brain is awake, or sometimes our brain is asleep when our body is awake. So there's sleepwalking, but there's also waking dreams. And I had something like a waking dream where your body is turned off, but you're fully conscious. You're still kind of paralyzed because your body is asleep. Sleep studies people have, looked into this very extensively. When they look into it extensively and conclude that it's what they call a hypnagogic or hypnopompic state, as opposed to alien visitation or demons, does that reflect their closed-minded paradigm that won't allow for the possibility of anything else? I don't think so. I think it is an outgrowth of them looking at the best evidence available to them. Now, if instead of my experience just, matching to a T these physiological states that sleep studies people have looked into, if it didn't match that to a T, but instead that little guy over in the corner by my bookshelf came over to me and poked me with something, and then I had a scar the next morning, and not just a little bump or, but like real evidential sort of something, then I wouldn't be here right now telling you that I had a hypnagogic or hypnopompic state. I would be here telling you someone, either broke into my apartment or there was an alien or something. Mm-hmm. I don't follow the evidence wherever it leads. I tell this to people when I have debates, God forbid, on God's existence. Mm-hmm. Not that that's the only thing we like to debate, but I've debated in front of, a couple thousand people whether or not God exists, and I say, and I mean when I say it, that if God exists, I don't want him to hide himself from me. He can convince everybody on the planet right now that he exists if he said in one loud booming voice, I am that I am, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So then you have theologians coming up with really great arguments for the existence of God called the hiddenness argument. God, here's evidence that God exists because he's so invisible, mm-hmm. I don't want to have to slip into sophistry in order to believe something. I want the things I believe in to be real common sense. When I go buy a car, you know, I'll kick the tires, I'll look under the hood, or I'll ask a mechanic to vouch for it, rather than just taking someone's word on something. When I have a personal experience that I can't explain, I'll look into the best explanations for it rather than just accepting the received wisdom of my culture or my religion. You know, what if my religion said that, you know, demons are real and they visit people all the time? You need to be on guard on it, on guard from it.
As some do.
Exactly, but that's not sufficient for me. I guess I'm a, you know, there's a certain kind of audacity, a certain even kind of rebelliousness in skepticism, where it says, you know, believe only those things for which there's adequate evidence. That's kind of, you know, on the one hand, everybody could say, well, I'm down with that. I agree. You don't want to believe things for which there's bad evidence, you know. So everyone on one level says, yeah, that makes sense. But they fail to realize that it's very controversial, actually, because if you consistently apply that kind of skepticism, again, not debunking, but just skepticism, where you only believe those things for which there's good evidence, you're necessarily going to overturn the basic assumptions of most people on the planet. That's why skepticism gets such a bad rap, because the implications of this point of view are dire for a lot of world belief systems.
No doubt. And that's really the bigger picture. And perhaps I don't want that to get lost in there. I mean, I think the skeptical position is one to be admired. And I do admire that. And especially in the larger social context in which we live, it's hard to maintain those beliefs. So I'm really fine-tuning my criticism, because it comes in a very kind of narrow band here. But I'll also say that, you know, you wouldn't believe the negative feedback I've gotten from skeptics who say, well, you're misappropriating the use of the word skeptic in the title of your podcast. And of course,
yeah, I think they're wrong about that. I think you have the same spirit of skepticism as I do. We may disagree on the answers. You know, the evidence compels you more than it compels me, but you know, you're certainly not a debunker, and from what I've heard of you, you're skeptical. The outcome's a little different, obviously, but I wouldn't reject you. I just wouldn't, you know, kick you out of the club of skepticism because you disagree with me on some of the answers.
Well, that's good, because I want to be in your club. But, you know,
there are no dues, so you're in.
Woo! And that really kind of brings me to kind of my last point, or my last criticism, if you will. And it's a difficult one, because it's hard on both sides, but perhaps it's something that we can work together a little bit to overcome. At least that's my hope. And that's that, you know, the skeptical community really hasn't done enough research. They've been long on criticism and short on getting behind research in a really open way. Now, you know, and I'm sure you would agree from all the things that you've said that whether you believe in the paranormal or not, you have to admit that questions like survival of consciousness after death are just fundamental to our understanding of the world.
More than that, they are so important to ask. Now, there are scientists who say, don't ask those questions. And I say to them, you know, you're wrong. I disagree with them. I think these questions should be asked. You and I agree about asking the questions. We even agree about, I think, at least so far from talking to you, we agree about skepticism versus debunking. Be skeptical. Consider or examine claims. You know, the word skepticism comes from the Greek skeptikos, which really means just to examine something carefully, right? So how could anyone say to anyone, don't be skeptical? Whatever you're going to be, don't be skeptical. You know, even a believer wants to be skeptical. You know, you want to examine something critically and believe in it, if you end up believing in it, because you have good reasons to believe in it. I think there is some problem. There are problems in the skeptical community. You mentioned being long on criticism and short on research. Center for Inquiry and PsychOp especially. It should be said that PsychOp just changed its name to CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, to reflect kind of a broader emphasis. So we're not just looking at the paranormal, but we're inquiring skeptically into all kinds of claims in society. In any case, it should be said that PsychOp is the, or CSI, is the only organization of its kind that has been working very hard over the years to not just spout off from an armchair, you know, criticizing this or that paranormal belief, but actually going out there in the field and looking at things. Joe Nickel, whom you mentioned earlier, you know, I travel almost every weekend these days because we're in a real growth spurt here at the Center for Inquiry. We're opening new branches and we're developing more grassroots support than we ever have. And I'm in a hotel room, you know, a majority of the week sometimes. And no matter where I'm at, I flip on TV and, gosh, Joe Nickel is haunting me because I can't get rid of him. He's on TV all the time. Now, why is he on TV? Just to sit in an armchair and saying, no, that can't be the case. You know, those people are wrong because they believe in something I don't believe. You know, he never says that. He says often, well, I don't know. You know, someone says, is it possible that that could have happened? And he says, sure, it's possible. He's a skeptic. He's not a debunker. And he is unique, almost unique, in the pantheon of kind of public skeptics out there, because he goes like a crime scene investigator. He goes as a paranormal scene investigator, really looking in an open-minded way at the evidence. Let me contrast that with this recent spate of Ghostbusters on TV, right? Makes for good TV, but these people who begin with an assumption, the assumption is the paranormal exists, are looking for any kind of evidence to support that claim. And they get their gizmos that they buy, you know, from the vendors, you know, these these magnetic machines or, you know, whatever these things are called, right? These little handheld devices that beep and move and whatever. That's not what Joe Nickel does. Joe Nickel investigates something like a detective would, you know, or like a police officer would or a crime scene investigator. What they do is something else entirely. And so I'm not as critical of the paranormalists as I am of those making a buck off the paranormalists by, you know, selling them a bill of goods that they may or may not believe, but at least makes good TV.
Well, yeah, and I think you make a good point on discernment, and I would, and that is just that, you know, you have to be discerning no matter what you're investigating. And let me tell you where I was leading to. Right now, Skeptico is in the process of working with the University of Arizona's Laboratory for the Advances of Consciousness and Health,
right,
by Gary
right.
Schwartz, and we're going to underwrite an experiment on the survival of consciousness after death. And one of the real unique aspects of this project is that it's going to be what I've been calling open source. That is, you know, the open source concept in computers. Everything about the design, the research protocols, as much as we can make possible, is going to be published beforehand, open to public input and debate. And the actual experiments themselves through the internet are going to be open for anyone to see at every phase. And,
well, that all of that sounds sensible to me. I just I have a cheeky question to ask you.
Sure.
Let's say you do all the research and you don't find a darn thing to support your, I mean, come on, admit, on one level, wouldn't it be great to prove that, you know, survival of consciousness after death? Obviously, you think it's great. It's an interesting subject. And you, on one level, at least, you'd love to prove it. What will you do if, after earnestly looking at all those questions, you don't find any evidence for it? Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We both agree.
No, totally fair question. Totally fair question.
But what if you don't find any evidence to support the claims in this series of you know, researches?
I suggest, DJ, that you and I have a friendly wager because, I mean, this is really what it comes down to.
The friendliest wager, you know, a couple rounds of drinks at one of the bars there in Tucson. I'm there a few times a year. We'll do it.
There you go. And I'll fly over. I'm in San Diego and I'll bring some San Diego favorites for your
okay.
enjoyment.
Count me in.
But the real point is it's a very fair question. And I've thought of it. I've thought about that. I've thought about the whole field because I'm not I can't say that I'm convinced that everyone I've spoken to has found the truth in their paranormal research.
Right.
But I'll tell you one thing that's encouraging to me. When I talked to Gary Schwartz, who is a very, very, you know, well-credentialed guy, Harvard PhD, and was the head of the psychology department at Yale, as well as being a physician and everything else, has published hundreds of...
Yeah, I'm familiar with Schwartz.
No hesitation. No hesitation. Shall we do this? Can we underwrite this? Totally open. Bring it on. Do it. Do it in a way that we address the skeptical concerns up front, so there's no room for ambiguity on the back end. That in and of itself is, that doesn't mean everything, but that's better than someone.
Look, I'll admit that's a good start, right? That's a good start. That's how you want, when you're looking at these questions, you want to do it with transparency. You want to do it inviting as many people to, you know, poke their head in and look at what you're doing as possible.
And that's what I'd ask you to do. And through your influence in the CFI, just to the extent that you feel it's appropriate, I'd like to invite you and anyone you feel is appropriate to participate in it. And it will be on the web, so it's not any kind of special participation. But
well, Joe Nickel and some of the other people at CFI and PsyCop who are specialists in this area, they'll also look into all this too. This gets back to what I said near the beginning. These questions are important, and it's not fair to the skeptical community for believers who wouldn't themselves be considered skeptics, even by themselves, right? It's not fair for believers to say, you skeptics, you don't care about these questions. You just want to reject any of these claims without even looking at them. That's not fair. I think it's commendable that, you know, look, we're having a good conversation right now. It's commendable for those believers who say, you know what, I'm not threatened by the skeptic. Now, you don't have to like a debunker, but I'm not threatened by a skeptic, says, you know, some or another believer. Why shouldn't he be threatened by the skeptic? Because the skeptic helps keep him honest. We're all open to the perils of self-deception. And
right.
You know, we get right. we get our egos invested in certain results. The skeptic does for the paranormal believer what any scientist does for any other scientist, which is keep them honest. Because even the best scientists are open to these pitfalls, right? And if scientists are open to these pitfalls of bias, self-deception, etc., someone who might not be even very trained in the methods of science, but just looking into questions because of a personal motivation, is especially open to these pitfalls. So I think a skeptic is a believer's best friend. Now, no, I'm not saying a debunker is, but a skeptic is a believer's best friend.
I think you make a good point. DJ, to kind of wrap up, can you tell us anything else that we might want to know that's going on at CFI or Point of Inquiry? Anyone who's special announcements or folks that are coming up that we might want to listen to?
Well, there are a couple interesting things happening in the future with the Center for Inquiry, and I mentioned this. We are going through a dramatic growth spurt. More people are coming out of the woodworks, in America than ever before, even around the world, saying the perspective that you bring to these important issues of concern, CFI, well, that's a perspective I haven't heard enough and I want to hear much more of, and here's my help. So people are donating more than they've ever donated. That's not the only indication of an organization's success, but it's a good indicator. People are getting more involved than they've ever gotten involved before. We're starting more groups than we've ever started. We're training more investigators and spokespeople and leaders. We're opening branches. In 2007, we aim to found new centers for inquiry in San Francisco, Chicago, Austin, and Indianapolis, of all places. That's because we have strong local leadership in those cities. We have a lot of donor support and other interest, and we're committing our resources to bring big events to these cities, in addition to the other six North American cities where we're located as branches, as centers for inquiry. And those cities are Toronto, New York City, D.C., Hollywood, California, Tampa, and here at the center's headquarters in Amherst, New York, in Buffalo, New York. So that's one thing to announce. We're on a growth spurt, and anyone who cares about these questions that you and I are talking about, I invite you, I appeal to you to get involved in helping us continue to make an impact. That's one thing. Second thing is about point of inquiry. I could not have predicted, shows you how bad a psychic I am, that Point of Inquiry would have caught on like it has. It's now the most popular program of its kind out there, and we're gratified that we've never had a declination. The leading lights of the day, as you know, you listen to the show, you know, they are happy to come on the show. Preach their sermons to the skeptic listener, but be challenged about their beliefs, and we think that's important. You know, this isn't a Sunday morning religious broadcast where you're only hearing one perspective. We try to make sure that on Point of Inquiry you hear sometimes not both sides, because sometimes there are many sides to an issue. You know, you hear a lot of opposing views. Upcoming guests, well, you know what, I won't let the cat out of the bag because I'd get scolded from Thomas Donnelly, but I will tell you we have some really, really exciting things in the works, some big names, and names that I never thought I'd be talking to. You know, in my life I never thought I'd be having a half an hour, an hour conversation with some of our upcoming guests. So stay tuned, and I look forward to continuing the conversation with you as well. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, it has for me too, and I, for one, will continue listening to Point of Inquiry, and I certainly encourage everybody to. It's just a wonderful, wonderful show, and thanks again for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you again. I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks again to DJ Grothy for joining us today. If you'd like to know more about Point of Inquiry or the Center for Inquiry, head on over to the Skeptico website, that's skeptiko.com, where you'll find links in our show notes. We also have some links in there to DJ's website. And while I'm speaking of the website, please keep us in mind. Keep all those emails and voicemails coming. Make sure you sign up for our email list so I can keep you up to date on what's going on. And continue thinking about us and telling your friends about us and writing good reviews about us and all those things that get the word about Skeptico out there. Well, that about does it for this episode. Bye for now.